Warning, this podcast has stories of real-life events and true crime that happens every day. These stories may contain adult language and graphic or disturbing details not suitable for everyone. Listener discretion is advised. In our society, most people are content to go through their daily lives safely and peacefully. But our society is not always safe or peaceful. For that reason, some men and women answer a higher calling to defend and protect their fellow man. You probably know someone who is one of these people, or maybe you are one of these people. The ones who see and do the things most people would never want to. These things are sometimes heroic and beautiful, but often they are horrific and terrifying. It's these things they don't share about with other people. It's these things they carry with them, so you don't have to. But when they get together, they talk to each other about them. And they call these stories war stories. Welcome to another episode of the War Stories Podcast. I'm Tom, and John will be joining us shortly as he's getting hosed with graveyard shift again after graveyard shift. But in the meantime, we're back to finish our to start the beginning of the end of our series with the Marines in Afghanistan of the 3-7. And so we've got Jacob back. How are you, my dude? You're just living the dream with your eyes open, right? And you've got Carrie with us. How are you, Carrie?
I'm doing good. It's good to be back. I'm just on my way back home from another family trip. Last one of the season.
Yep. And then we've also got someone new with us, which is Lorenzo. Welcome, Lorenzo. How are you?
Doing well. Just trying to get through the grind at work. And yeah, glad to be on your show.
And Lorenzo, we're going to probably have to ask Lorenzo back because Lorenzo works for a fire department up in the Pacific Northwest. And as firemen are often able to do, they're able to do other things while they're working, you know, like sleep, watch TV, things like that. So Lorenzo,
I work really hard
when you work.
Yes. Yeah. A lot of sweat involved.
Right. So Lorenzo is actually able to join us from, you know, he's working right now, but if he gets a call, we'll so much the better. You just have to come back and tell us when you get back on what the call was.
Okay. We'll do.
So now, Jacob, we're going to pick up where we left off, and why don't you kind of give us, because we had an episode in between the last, give us a little, review of where we're at.
All right, so basically we got up to the point now where we had we started pushing through the hedgerows, started making our push in there. We established fires. From fires, we started branching out. Obviously, after those 5 to 8 days there, we had a couple good fights, obviously, like we talked about with like the 500-pound bomb incident. And then, like Joan said, like the A-10 where they thought they were going to hit them too. But we got to the point there where we decided to go ahead and make our final push towards the river. And it was going to be essentially 1 day push that we were going to break through, take Dragon, and then to continue to push through and take all the way up to what we had planned was to take PB Bulldog and PB Hellman, which would allow us to basically eliminate any enemy movement, ingress and egress along the Hellman River. Obviously, those plans throughout that day, it was like one of the longest days. Obviously, we had Jones that got hit, and we got up to that point where he had just got Kazovac'd out. And that's where we kind of left off at, as we let Jones tell the rest of his recovery aspect of, especially like from the point he got hit and then going through to getting out. And then afterwards, the mindset that he was going through after becoming a double leg amputee.
So now Jones is not here to make us all feel bad about what little we have done with our lives.
Yeah.
So I guess we could all still feel a little bit better about ourselves. Where do you guys want to go today? What we've got like 2 or 3 episodes left to finish this series out. You saying that you want to pick right back up at that point, correct?
Yep. We're going to pick up at that point because that was just the beginning of the day. That was right away in the morning when Jones got hit. And then from there, we're going to basically wrap up the Kilo aspect today in Weapons Company, along with state platoon that was attached to us. So we're going to essentially wrap up the kilo aspect today and then go into next, the next episode. We'll be going into what India and Lima were doing along with the Sangin push. Once they pushed in like about a week, week and a half after us. That day, that was just the beginning of it when Jones got hit. Obviously, Hernandez first stepped on the first low order IED that we heard the pop. And then obviously then Jones went up to start to clear, and that's when he got hit. So we ended up pushing, we ended up pulling first squad back, and we ended up retracting our steps and allowing third squad to go ahead and push up. And we got to the point where we're like, all right, well, we know there's IEDs over here on this echelon of this hedgerow. So we're going to go ahead and try to go around it, stay to the outskirts of the path to protect the engineers as they're trying to get this bridge put together to allow the vehicles to keep pushing forward. And so we were trying to skirt around this separate tree line. And obviously when Jones got hit, like me and him had talked about on the last episode when he was here, was when he got hit, that's one thing that I always will remember and I'll never forget is his screams, is the fact that like once he got hit, it was just like 5-10 seconds, you heard the boom, and then it was immediately just like he said, like taking in a bigger breath, bigger breath, bigger breath, and just letting it all out. So we were listening to that as then we decided to go ahead and continue to push forward. As we start to skirt this other tree line, which another engineer had come up and cleared us a path, so we just started to follow that one. As we were coming up through that adjacent tree line for cover and concealment, then I remember this, it was me, Frixel, Hill, and Scott up in the front taking point. And as we walked past there, Staff Sergeant Fernandez, our platoon sergeant, had come up and caught up with us and stopped ahead of me and took a step like kind of off to the side, stood there. And he was like, okay, you guys go ahead and keep going, keep going. No one else is getting hurt today. As we passed through there, started to push up and we were coming across there, Frixel, myself, Hill, and Scott all started to pass him. Well, then Fernandez took one more step, and it was just like a slight sidestep, like just like, you know, readjusting your feet, stepped on a pressure switch.
That close to him.
Oh, yeah, it was that close to him. We all stepped basically right over it. I mean, any of us could have stepped on it, all four of us ahead of him. So he gets hit, and I still remember the explosion right behind me. And I hit the ground and everybody else started like it was like that kind of pause moment. Like, what the fuck was that? What the fuck was that? Look behind us. It's just this cloud of dust. Like, it's all the moon dust. We can't see anything. Frixel comes up, grabs me, make sure, hey, you good? You good? Yeah, I'm good. We look back behind us. We see Hill laying, and naturally it's Caveman Hill. Face down in the dirt. We think he's dead. Like, we think he stepped on it. And so we run up to him, grab him, freaking mouthful of dirt, freaking just completely covered in shit. And we pick him up, and he has no idea where he's at, what's going on, anything. So I grab him. Frixel continues to go down the line to check on Scott. And he finds Scott, and then he ends up finding V, Doc Slate, and Staff Sergeant Fernandez. And Staff Sergeant Fernandez is the one that's hit. So they immediately start doing that. I get Hill set up in a position next to me. I grab Scott. Scott gets up next to me too. We immediately start looking out for targets because obviously right after Jones got hit, they started shooting at us too. So we're just kind of waiting for it at this point. We start going through the whole CASAVAC point. But this time with Fernandez, he did not make a peep. There was no screaming. There was no crying out for help or anything. This guy was calm as a Hindu cow, and he was just laying there and letting people work on him. From what V and Frixel were telling me, and later I found out, Doc Slate had run up to him right away, but he was right next to him, and he was trying to put the tourniquets on. Well, comes to find out from the overpressure, it broke his wrist, and he couldn't get the tourniquets on Staff Sergeant Fernandez. So V and Frixel, they start getting the tourniquets on him and everything. For he was a single leg amputee. And as we're sitting there starting to get the CASVAC caught up and called up, and we're trying to figure out a plan of how to get out of here now, because we realized, like, fuck, all right, we can't go back the way we came, because obviously there's more IEDs here. We could have all stepped over one at any point from where Jones got hit. So we were sitting there, and as we're continuing to observe the area, we start taking a series of pop shots, and then we start taking direct fire from some RPKs and some other small arms fire, AKs and stuff. And they start directly hitting on us, and there's a compound. We can tell where they're shooting from. There's a compound through the tree line that we're next to, about 50 meters out. And so they're shooting at us through the murder holes. And so we're still working on the casualty. Me and Hill start getting our saws up, just providing suppressive fire, just trying to do what we can. At that point, V, as he's doing the CASVAC, ended up calling in. We had a helicopter support. I don't know what ended up shooting it, but they ended up dropping a hellfire into this building. And as soon as it hits, it was kind of that same pause, 5-10 seconds. Well, this time, though, there was multiple screams, and you could hear all these guys that were just shooting at us screaming. And each one, you could kind of tell the different pitches and who it was and everything else. And it's on the other side of the IED belt, so we're just going to sit here, get our casualty out. As we start getting the litter loaded up with Fernandez to take him back to the truck, it was kind of honestly like that point where it was music to our ears. Like, all these guys that were just shooting at us probably laid the IEDs. They're all screaming, and no one's coming to save them, but we're going to save our own. And so,
right. I mean,
yeah.
And you drop a hellfire missile on them, you kind of leave them alone.
Yeah. And it was kind of that point where it was, happy satisfaction that, hey, even though two of our guys got hit, we're going to take care of them. No one's coming to save those fuckers. They can.
Yeah. I mean, people don't understand who have never had somebody try to kill them. There is a certain satisfaction in getting to try and kill somebody else back, you know?
Yeah. And so, yeah, So it was kind of it was that little victory that we could hear all seven of them as they were, like, you know, crying out for help and stuff, and the screaming, and no, and each one just slowly drowning out as they were expiring. And so at that point, we got the police litter pulled up, and we got, and Fernandez was not a small dude. My platoon sergeant was a pretty hefty dude. Like, they later told him that if he would have been smaller, he would have been a double leg amputee, but luckily he was such a big guy, his body did a great job of absorbing the blast. So
you're saying he was so big the bomb was only powerful enough to take one leg?
Yeah, essentially. Yeah. So we get him loaded up on the litter, and this is kind of the funny part of the day that I always laugh about, even as bad as that day was, is it's happy teabag day. So we get him loaded up, and we're carrying him to the MRAP that came up from Kilo Mobile. And one of my guys, Bustamante, is in the vehicle, and he's the turret gunner. So he got out, opened the doors for us, and we're all carrying him, and I'm on the back side of the litter, and me being the tallest person, they all hand the front part of the litter up to him. And as he gets it, we start pushing it in. Well, he didn't push down on that side of the litter to counter the weight. So Fernandez starts sliding back down towards me. And so his one leg, it looks like an umbrella with the bones that's just sticking out, what's left of it. That smacks me in the face. And he always bragged about going commando because he never wore anything. All his dick and balls is hanging out of his pants. And everything comes sliding down towards me. So his bone hits me in the face, and then all of a sudden his dick and balls just implant right on my fucking forehead.
But now you have to be honest, which was worse? Was it the just horrendously deformed bone and flesh, or the dick and balls? Which was worse?
I honestly want to say that it was honestly probably the dick and balls, just for the fact that his dick came down my face and was on my lip to the point where I couldn't cry out for help. Otherwise, we would have probably got him in a different arousal position. He was losing enough blood the way it was.
So basically you can't cry out and tell anyone that his dick and balls are in your face for fear that by opening your mouth you will receive it in your mouth.
Yeah, so that's me at this point. And Bustamante and finally the other three guys that were helping me carry the litter turn around and see what's going on. So Bustamante pushes down, we get him pushed back up on the litter, we get him dragged in there. I think that was Pena that jumped back up in the truck and helped him, dragged him back up to get him centered on the litter. And we were at that point, we're like, okay, well, I just got teabagged for the day. All right, here we go. So we get out and the truck takes off and we got him CASEVAC'd out. He's completely fine. They end up going through. He's doing great nowadays from what I hear. So that's good. And he kind of had to go through the same recovery process that Jones did. Obviously for him, everything was, his amputee was below the knee. So that was a good point. So it wasn't to a point where he was going to have to go above the knee and have to do that process, which is always harder if anything goes above the knee. At that point, then, we start to get ready to keep pushing, the engineers and, our tanks that are there, are finally set up to keep pushing. So, and it took like another probably half hour to an hour, because I remember Hill was still just dazed as fuck, to the point where at one point we were sitting there along this cleared path and he's getting shot at and doesn't even notice it. He's just completely in deja vu and freaking in a whole different universe, to the point where he was actually getting, like, rounds were going everywhere. One actually destroyed one of his spare barrels, if I remember correctly. And so I ran over to him and started shooting right above his head, and that's how he ended up busting his eyebrow open, because he slammed his head against his freaking saw, because he had no idea what was going on until I started shooting right above his head at the people that were shooting at him. And then at that point we went ahead and started clearing forward, and we got pushed up. Got across the last canal. We ended up taking Bulldog, and then we ended up taking PB Hellman, which is up along the river. They're about 200 meters apart, but PB Hellman allows you to see both sides of the river going to the east, west, and up to the north across the river. And it was just big enough for one squad, maybe plus. It was literally, if one mortar would have hit in there, everybody would have died. And yeah, that's how small that patrol base was. But we get set up there. And by the way, Bulldog, we're still sitting next to those, you know, three unexploded 500 pound bombs less than 50 meters away that are sitting in the adjacent building that are just still sitting there underground. So that's when the next day or not, yeah, the next afternoon, that's when they started the digging expedition to dig those up to get the computer boards or whatever out of them.
So now, Lorenzo, you're just joining us on this one. You haven't been on the show. What part of the 3-7 are you assigned to?
So I was in shadow with the snipers. So at this point in time that he's talking about, so we're pushing into patrol base Bulldog. Bulldog was kind of, I'd call it the bastard child of all the patrol bases that we had out there. It was an area that I guess was important for observation and maintaining eyes on the route for resupplies along the patrol bases. But we really didn't operate out of there a whole lot, especially as sniper teams. A lot of what we had going on was back at patrol base Fires, patrol base Dragon, and also patrol base Hellman. So, where Jacob's leaving off at, so we completed our push to Patrol Base Hellman, and it was called Patrol Base Hellman because it's right on the Hellman River. I mean, you could throw a rock into the river from the patrol base.
Yeah, I figured it wasn't because of the mayonnaise.
Yeah, yeah. But remember getting to Patrol Base Hellman, we got there kind of late in the day, and there might have been some shenanigans as far as jumping in the river that evening with Overwatch, of course.
Yeah, why not?
But that was the first time that any of us had a chance for like a shower or any type of hygiene processes in a while since we had initiated our push into Sangin. I recall
it's a really good picture of all of those guys in the creek, in the river, that little
There's a canal right behind Throw Base Helmand as well. I mean, right out the back door, filled with all sorts of crabs and stuff that the corpsman told us not to eat, but it's food. So anyways, I remember getting to Patrol Base Helmand, staying the night there, and we came back the next day to Patrol Base Bulldog, and we're kind of consolidating our teams there and figuring out what our next plan of attack was going to be for us as snipers. And we had gotten a call from Patrol Base Helmand. They had started taking some enemy fire from across the river as well as northeast of it. That sound correct to you, Jacob? Were you on Patrol Base Helmand at that time?
No, I was back at Bulldog there at first. We pushed Kilo 2 or Kilo 3-2. So second squad went up to Lopez's squad, went up to Helmand that first night. And then first squad and third squad got stuck back at Bulldog, where we thought we were going to be able to rest, but then we immediately started building the Great Wall of Afghanistan with the sandbags. And then we basically, since it was set up on the way the compound was set up, we cut out with pickaxes and anything else we could find. We cut out like holes big enough to basically put our post on the inside and then built sandbag posts out of it.
So, you made a fort.
Mm-hmm.
All the blankets and pillows and stuff as
put
a child.
The sheets over the top.
It was fun.
So, like you're saying, there's one squad of Marines that are left at Patrol Base Helmand. Basically, they're to man it, and it's a pretty small patrol base. You couldn't fit much more than a squad of Marines in there anyways. And I recall them getting a hold of us saying that they were taking contact from across the river and northeast of it, of the patrol base. And it was, they were engaging from like 800 meters. It was stuff like RPKs and dudes popping out from around corners and kind of spraying with an AK-47. Not really very effective fire, but they got a hold of us and they're like, hey, we could use some sniper support over here. And,
well, I mean, who can't, you know, if you can get some sniper support, why not?
And we can hear the rounds going off and everything. So we're kind of licking our chops to head over that way. And I want to say it was one of the CAT units came by, picked us up in an MRAP, and they drove us up to Patrol Base Helmand, and they basically backed us up to the entryway of it so that when we opened our doors, like, it's totally concealed. They couldn't see anybody getting into that patrol base. You don't necessarily want the enemy to know that there might be, you know, player two has entered the game.
Right. Exactly. So, you check the button that says appear offline.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we entered that patrol base, and I remember just kind of getting an initial scene size up of what was going on. And you could hear some rounds cracking overhead sporadically. Like I said, it was very ineffective fire. And so we kind of had plenty of time. I guess the only risk would be if they started lobbing mortars or something, but we weren't receiving any of that yet. And so I was on a long gun, and the Jew was there with the long gun, and we both had spotters with us. We might've had one other guy with us. So four to five guys from our platoon entered that area, and we had time to basically sit there and start lazing stuff out. And I would say, like, our initial engagements there, we were kind of getting a feel for the ranges, and it was super hot that day. So kind of getting dialed in. And then once we were dialed in, it was like, you know, all your target reference points and everything were almost off memory. You know, the corner of this building is going to be at this yardage. The edge of this cornfield is at that yardage. That was a lot better back then as far as knowing my gun. I'd gotten to the point where I could dial dope and have it memorized within 25 meter increments. So if I know the range of something, I know what my drop is going to be, and I'll be able to engage that target. But I remember this went on like all day. They kept like doing this harassing fire, and it was not going well for them. And I also remember the Jew called in. So I was listening to the previous podcast right before this one started, and it left off about the time that 500-pound bomb was dropped on us.
Right.
So everybody was kind of shaky about close air support. And the Jew called in a gun run we had an Apache on station. And being Marines from 29 Palms, what we were used to working with as far as rotary wing goes was Cobras. And so Cobras shoot a front 180 out of their gun. And so he calls in this Apache, and this Apache flies over our shoulders, and we're like, sweet, you know, it's time for, you know, get some America going. And
some freedom noise.
Guys right over us. He kind of takes a peek at the battle space and then flips around, and he starts coming, like his nose is pointed right at our patrol base. And all we can think of is, you know, the previous bomb that was dropped on us, and the A-10 was
right
pointing at us.
It's still fresh in your memory. Forget PTSD. This is just SD.
Yeah, it's right there. So then you see all this, you know, there's kind of a delay between when you see the brass falling into the sky and then hearing the sound of the gun going off.
Yeah, go look up, anybody who's listening, go look on YouTube and just go look up like an A-10, you know, the burr, that whole thing. You'll see things before you hear things.
Yes. So the bird's probably like, I'd say 600 yards away from us, but he's pointing right at us and he's dropping all this brass and we can hear the gun going off. Everybody's diving behind sandbags, just not having, straight up not having a good time. And, I remember we had our air officer was there, Eeyore. He was helping coordinate close air support. And he's looking at us like we're dipshits.
Okay,
like,
hold on. There's a story behind the name Eeyore, is there? Isn't there? There's got to be.
I believe that he was the mopey guy in flight school. And yeah, there's okay. Every one of those guys, their call sign has a story behind it.
All right.
But so Eeyore's looking at us like we're dumbasses. Like, why are you guys taking cover? I mean, he's sitting there watching the show and we're all cowering down behind sandbags and stuff. And we're like, he's pointing right at us. And he's like, no, you guys are good. He's shooting at them. And we're like, but he's pointing right at us. And he's like, no, and Patsy has 360 degrees. Like, they can shoot whatever direction they want. And we're like, oh, fucking Army, man.
All this stuff. Right, exactly. His gun moves.
Yeah, that day, there was good things that happened that day. I mean, I don't think that we took any casualties inside PB Hellman that day. I remember going through a lot of rounds, though, and it was kind of weird. The next day, any type of attacks coming from that direction, like, we weren't getting anything. And I remember talking to the Jew about it, and we're kind of looking around, scanning, trying to figure out what's going on. And that next day we could see there was a graveyard up on the hillside. It was probably about four clicks away. Our engagement range had been between 400 to 1,100 meters. And I'd say probably 50% of those engagements were across the river. And so that following day, though, we're looking at this. It looks like a graveyard up on the hill, and they were just trucking people up there all day. Like, they were kind of done.
Right.
They needed to figure their shit out.
Right. This did not work out for us.
Yeah.
Need a new plan.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, that was always awkward. At any of the graveyards, especially up there, the one graveyard next to Inkerman, they would always come up there like the next day after engagements and start burying people. And we're like, oh, were these the people that shot at us? No, yeah. No. Mm-hmm.
Right. Claiming. Uncomfortable.
Or claiming wrongful. Yeah.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Claiming that we killed, you know, wrongful people, the wrong people.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but that, once we established Bulldog and Hellman, we started like basically starting to get pushed out. Like we were like, hey, well, we can't sit here in a fixed position. Otherwise, they're going to start putting in IEDs on us. So we started basically pushing out to try to go pick a fight, which at that point, Carrie over there with Cat White, they were able to set up on certain parts. But then to our east/northeast, there was a branch of the Hellman River that we called the Mississippi that our vehicles could not cross. Once we went over there, it was basically no man's land because you had no vehicle support. And so that first night after we had set up Bulldog and Hellman, we pushed out that next morning. And I know which, I forget which one of your vehicles tried to cross it and got stuck. And I'm trying to remember, because I remember they were like, no, I got this. And they just floored it and they made it about halfway through.
I don't remember which vehicle it was either, but Session Ortiz was dead set on crossing it. And I think it was his call. And I forget who we had to come out there. Actually, Sergeant Major Black showed up at one point, I think.
Yeah.
Helped us figure out how to hook up the vehicle to pull it out, because there was like a how many Marines does it take to pull out a vehicle type of situation. And it was right there. It might have been right there on the part of the river where the engineers ended up putting the bridge. I think that might have been why they put the bridge. But that's from what I remember about that. But rewinding at the beginning of the day, I remember this whole day from my perspective with dysentery shit in my pants and just kind of watching, you know, when we did, I think that was one of the first times to shit myself, and it smelled just like Play-Doh. It smelled like salty Play-Doh. So if you just close your eyes, you can just kind of imagine
when you open a fresh can of Play-Doh.
Yeah. And then you kind of snap back to it and you're like, oh, wait a minute. I just have shit in my pants. And I'm not a kid playing with, this is not fun. But yeah, so we would push. And, I think when we got up to like Bulldog, that was when all the pot was there, right? All the pot really showed up.
Yeah.
All the marijuana plants.
Yeah, because that
really showed up around Bulldog.
Because that night before, when we were coming up to PB Bulldog, that's all you could smell is like literally.
Right,
just
and we
like,
were like, "What?
What the hell?"
We were like, "What is this?" So then it was like just slow creeping through to the marijuana field, and you know. Everybody on the ground moving up on the left and right and everything, taking PB Bulldog and everything, and listening. The whole thing with us was, since we had the trucks, our trucks were set up permanently outside of Bulldog, so it was like permanent watch for, you know, boots like me in the turret. I was just Mark 19, fire watch, and then if I was off shift, I was on inside Bulldog listening. You know, you're resting, and then I don't know. Every 5-10 minutes, you hear the snipers over there at PB Hellman just going off. They're like, "Oh man, they must see more people this and that." But they were getting after it. That whole push there was pretty cool.
Yeah, because
there was a pretty big buffer between PB Bulldog and the Mississippi, I think, wasn't there?
There was a day. Like we set up Bulldog, we set up PB Hellman, and we worked all throughout the, like we were going on shifts throughout the day, the night to get them fortified, building the forts. And like you said, like not pillow and blanket forts anymore. It's all right. We're going to fill about 10,000 sandbags and put a wall up outside. So we have secondary and tridary.
Tertiary.
Yeah. Tertiary. There we go. Speech impediment.
Got red hair. We'll excuse it.
Yeah. Thank you. Yes. Yeah. The ginger came out. But yeah, then that second day after, because it was that day we decided to push out and we took everybody. So we took all the shadow guys, Cat White pushed up along the Mississippi, and we literally left two guys at PB Bulldog and the guys at PB Hellman there. So we had two guys guarding like a platoon size level patrol base there at PB Bulldog. And we decided to push out, cross the Mississippi and go pick a fight over there because after they were smoke checking everybody, they decided to start going back into the green zone area and coming through the trees where then we figured out the crab shack over there where which the only reason we weren't allowed to burn that down is because shadow guys needed that as a reference point. All right.
It was a good reference point.
Hey, at this point, if he's dialing in his sniper shots based on, like, you know, markers on the ground and buildings, let him have it.
We just called it the crab shack.
It was in a spot where, like, it was on kind of an elevated piece of terrain with some dead space behind it. So, like, trying to get, like, a quick reference of anything within 200 meters forward or behind that was almost impossible unless you're actually lasing it. And so it was a good TRP for us. Bad spot to be if you're a bad guy.
Yeah, the only reason we wanted to burn it down is because when those guys would push out and go the other direction or whatever, and we didn't have that availability, they would always use that cover and concealment and come up there next to the crab shack and start launching RPGs and everything else at us. So it was kind of that point where you're just like, well, let's just burn this whole area down, all the elephant grass and everything else. That way we don't have to worry about it. No, we need that as a reference point. Fine. All right. We'll take the RPGs. Got it. All right. And that's coming up here with apparently they forgot to pull the pin on some of the RPGs, because then we'd have to go out there and find them. So we push out there, go pick a fight. And I still remember that because at this point, our CO, who's very, like, gung-ho, very good leader, and, like, you know, is just that guy that's going to go through it with you all. The God of War. He's not going to, like, Captain Cohen, he's not going to send us out there to do the dirty work and just, like, claim whatever. He's the one putting on all the war paint, and he goes rolling out there with us. So that next morning, when they kept shooting at us from over there, and they launched a couple RPGs, they dropped a couple mortars. So we're like, all right, let's go. So he grabs all the shadow guys, starts pushing out. All the rest of us, they were like, okay, well, we're going to leave two guys here and everybody else, we're going. So we go out there and pick a fight, cross the Mississippi, which was, it's about a chest deep river. So you're literally going through the river. Part
Vietnam style, guns up.
Guns up.
That's to be the short guy.
Oh yeah, I'll bet.
Hey, don't worry. Remember, Gio's shorter than you. I lost him a couple times in the canal.
Oh, I wasn't the short guy. I just remember looking at those guys like, can I get you a straw?
Yeah, is there any, like, bamboo reeds around here we can make a Bugs Bunny snorkel?
Yeah, a couple of the guys, it was like, piggyback, get on me, bud. I'll carry you. It's all right. If we hit one of the wires going through the canals, we'll both go. I got you, bro. I just don't want to go diving for your body or look for your gear at that point. But we got up there, went out there, pushed for about 8 hours, just, you know, fire maneuver all day, just going through it again. We were back at it. And then finally, at the end of the day, they disengaged. They ended up calling in a couple airstrikes where we figured out where their egress rat was going across the river, which across the river, there's another whole village on the desert side right along the river. And it's up on a high step, like, freaking, it starts low, goes all the way up this hillside. And that's where the cemetery is at, which is what Lorenzo was talking about, is that whole cemetery up there. And that was a whole troubled spot. And eventually we got, I believe it was, I think it was India or it might've been Lima Company that ended up sending a whole platoon over there. Was it India? Yeah. And they sent everybody along with support vehicles, and they cleared that whole side at like a couple, it was probably 2 weeks in. And then those guys were dug in on the hillside, living out of holes over there for a while. And we'd be waving at each other across the river. And every single time shit kicked off, they'd either start shooting at them on the green side or they'd shoot at us. And then we'd be able to, you know, coordinate. And if I remember right, I forget what point that was. I remember we were all talking about it at one point, because that's when Lorenzo, what were those fancy goggle things you guys brought that went off the 119 batteries?
It's binoculars.
LRTV.
Oh, what are they?
So LRTV is a long range thermal vision, and was at the time, it was like the latest and greatest piece of kit that we had. I think it had a 3-power optical zoom and like a 12-power digital zoom or something like that. But you could look at stuff at night And at 1,000 yards, you could tell whether or not a dude had a magazine in his AK or not. They were a really good piece of gear to have for the area that we were in. But we only had a couple of them, and so they were kind of a needed resource.
A hot item. For one Christmas gift list.
Because I just remember, was that the Jew or was that you that shot the guy through the tree when they decided to hit us really hard that day from across the river and on our side of the river?
Ooh, through the tree? That might have been the Jew.
Yeah, because I
sounds
just
like
remember,
a Jew thing to do.
Yeah, because I just remember he missed him the first time, and he's like, "Oh, he's hiding behind a tree," and that's when he had the sasser set up there at PB Hellman, and he's like, "Oh, I got this," and he blew the guy from behind the tree, and
blew him away. It just blew him away. Him, yeah. Blew him is a whole different thing.
There. There it is.
He blew him.
Yeah, but
for
at that
sure.
point,
actually,
yeah,
I.
Oh, go ahead.
I think that might have been another one of our guys. He's still doing some different work, but I know who you're talking about.
Someone we can't talk about.
He was probably like our main 50 cal guy as far as the Barrett goes. He was
Jason,
real good at handling that. What's that?
Jason?
No, it wasn't Jason.
Oh, okay.
It was Cody.
So get across the Mississippi, and what's your next obstacle or objective?
Our next obstacle was basically controlling the area. Essentially, now that we had all the patrol bases set up all the way from Fob Inkerman all the way through, so we had Fob Inkerman, then it went Fires, then Dragon, then Bulldog, and then Hellman, and basically, we were controlling that whole route, which those guys, the sneaky fuckers that they were, they started flooding some of the canals. So it would destroy Route Cohen that wouldn't allow us to push vehicles up. And so we had to bring in a track out there, like a front end loader, to start trying to fix some of it. And then we had the issue with that they would sneak through the canals, put up like flour sacks that are basically like they throw it in the moon dust and cover it with moon dust. And it was just a short little pressure switch, just enough to blow a tire off or to hit us. And they would also sneak up with goats where they would have the flour sack IEDs that they would just cut off the goats as they're walking through with them, acting like they're farmers and everything. And then obviously it was just daily contact. We'd be sitting there at the patrol bases. We started trying to push out night OPs. At certain points, those worked. At one point, we did spot a couple, like one of the nights that, you know, Shadow left me up there at PB Hellman, that I'm using their fancy things. And one of our areas that we had just patrolled earlier that morning, I spot three guys, and two of them with backpacks, and one of them with a shovel, and the other guy with an AK. And they're about roughly 500 meters out. And so they're up there towards the crab shack trying to backlay us. And so they're trying to put IEDs in. So these guys had gone towards the west thinking they were going to go see action over there. Well, these guys, I don't know how they ran that fast from their grid where they were at, but they ran all the way back, got back to PB Hellman, and then ended up doing a frame shot on those three guys out there. We got those guys, and then at that point then it was just like daily patrols, like, hey, one guy's you guys are going out this way, go pick a fight, you guys are going out this way. And since we had cut off everything coming from the Kajaki Dam, the only way they could get in now is going all the way down towards Musa Kalaw and coming in on that other crossing. So now we're kind of pinned between the east and the west. And that's the reason that India Company and Lima Company made their pushes to the west, southwest of us, to take those areas around Nolay and Jackson to basically eliminate enemy movement coming into the Sangin Valley. And that was all coming up here. But yeah, at that point when we were sitting there, it was basically like you sit there all night. They wouldn't really do much at night besides spotting guys planting IEDs. But then that next morning, it's literally like, all right, well, here we go again as the sun starts to rise. And even if it wasn't a full-on deal, like, they would at least have one jackass that's out there with an RPK or a couple AKs that would just start shooting at the patrol bases.
So it's not legitimate attempts to overrun your position as more as it is like an annoyance or harassment fire.
Well, and at certain points they were testing us. Like, right. They would, and then like they would test us one day, see what we were going to do, and then react to that the next day. So like, hey, if we shoot RPGs at them, they're going to push a squad out. And all right, we push a squad out. So the squad, as they're leaving, starts taking contact immediately. And like just it full on. So then it goes to there. And then if the squad pushes out, they would move away from the squad and then start pushing guys up towards the patrol base when they know there's less Marines.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah. So they were basically like, they would continue to test us like that. And their favorite thing to do was basically lure us out and then try to hit us while we're out in the open or like while we're pushing through fields and everything else. That's essentially what they continued to do through that time period. And luckily we started getting, I guess, savvy about it, being able to like, hey, we're going to be pushing this squad out at like 05 under darkness and start pushing them out there. And then we'd have air support on station already and just basically hovering around, like not too close to us, but just enough to be able to respond within like 5-10 minutes. And so that's what we basically continued to do. But yeah, some of those RPGs, like they shot a couple of them at us one day when we built the new shitters outside with HESCO, because filling HESCO by hand is so much fun.
Yeah, I don't imagine that's a really, you know, fun pastime. Those HESCO barriers.
A lot of cubic yards.
Yeah, right.
The RPGs were such a big theme of that push to the river, and just it's just the Sangin part in general. And that's, you know, to me, that's what I remember the most, especially being in a vehicle, was just constant RPG fire, just always. And it's like, can you give me a freaking break here, you know? 107 rockets and RPG. And then, you know, the guys on the ground, Lorenzo and Fry, like they said, it was just constantly. It would start with RPGs. Everything would start with RPGs, and then they would go after them, you know. But it was just, at some point, it just became, you know, oh, there goes a rocket. Where's the smoke at? Where's the poo site? There's the poo site. Everybody unload a can over there. I don't know where, but just at the smoke. Shoot at the smoke. Shoot at the smoke, into your cans, and we'll see what happens. You know, see if they keep shooting.
Yeah, that would be the one beneficial thing about RPGs is it leaves a beautiful trail right up to its origin point.
I'm telling you, just a big poo site. But I got a funny story about Lorenzo there. Back at PB Dragon, I think, we were talking about it a little earlier. They were taking, I don't know if it was this early on, it might have been later on when we kind of dispersed everybody again along that route. They were taking semi-accurate pot shots, you know, over there, PB Dragon. And they're like, okay, well, we need some snipers over here to pinpoint this motherfucker shooting at us. And Lorenzo was up on the roof with caminating or something. I remember somebody said you creeped up there super slow and it was really good. It was, to us, it was obvious, but I guess it was kind of a pretty good dark hindsight. Anyways, we pull up in the truck and my vehicle commander, Mahaffey, gets out and is running across the bridge trying to draw fire from this guy or something. He's got a cigar in his mouth and he gets a couple pot shots from the guy, and Lorenzo's up there watching like, keep going, he did some shots from this guy. That was pretty funny. Looking back, it was pretty nuts, but it was pretty funny at the time.
Right. I mean, it's kind of funny where your mind is at when these things are going on, where the stuff that you'll laugh at. And that's part of one of the things when we talk, we only talk to each other about some of that stuff, is because we talk about the stuff we laugh at and everybody else looks at us like we're insane.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, as I giggle, Yeah, I remember that scenario that Gary's talking about. Actually, a good majority of our platoon had been requested to support Lima Company at that time. And so I believe that we were down to 10 Marines in our platoon at that point. So 8 Marines from our state platoon went to go support Lima, and they left 2 with Kilo Company. It was me and I'll call him Renegade. So we were at Patrol Base Dragon, and like Kerry was saying, this place kept taking pot shots, so that was a spot for us to be. Patrol Base Dragon had a canal that ran right out in front of it, maybe like 10 feet in front of it. And on the other side of that canal was an MATV that was posted up there to watch this supply route that we had. So the supply route would hit this bridge, go across the canal, and it would go up to PV Bulldog, and then it would continue on to PV Hellman. And so this guy keeps taking these pot shots, and it's basically every time that there's a resupply or a convoy coming up that supply route. And mind you, the equipment that we had then was not very good. Like, we had open top 7 tons. So,
oh,
I mean,
yeah. We've heard about those open top 7 tons and how effective they were at protecting you guys.
Yeah. So we had those. And I mean, if they were bringing up like another squad of Marines to reinforce one of the patrol bases, you know, they're carrying them in a open top 7 ton most of the time. And so this guy was taking pop shots anytime that there was a convoy going by. And so this actually took me like 3 days. So the first day, I crossed the canal with my spotter. He actually went out there. He brought the 50 with him because he wanted to deliver some hate. Actually, he wasn't one of our shooters. So I had a Mark 11 and he had an M4. But when the rest of the section left us, they left us with one of the 50 cals. So I was like, yeah, might as well take that thing out there. And yeah, so right. He set up on basically the mine roller, this MATV, looking out. And I was watching towards the west where this is coming from. And what I did was I got up in the turret of the MATV, had the gunner sit down below. And I rotated the 240. When I got out there, they told me an area where they thought he was shooting from. And so I rotated the 240 away from that section, basically to make it kind of look like it's unobserved. And I put a poncho liner over the top of the turret so you can't see inside of it. And I set my rifle up there facing the direction the shots are coming from. And I could use the buttstock of the 240 as the rear rest for my rifle if I had to take a shot. And, I remember the first day.
Snipers are sneaky fuckers. I'll tell you what. Yeah. I love it.
So this guy, I just started writing down profiles of people that were in the area, particularly after shots were taken, and couldn't pinpoint where it was coming from. And I had a couple of, I guess you'd call them uniforms, like the garb that they were wearing that I had in my notebook. And so it had to have been like one of these three people that were taking the shots and probably ditching the rifle somewhere. And so I see this one guy that I've kind of had my eye on, and he comes down and he speaks with a couple of the farmers that are out in the field, like with they weren't shoveling. They had like hoes or rakes or something. They're out there farming. Not much we could do about that other than observe them. And so he speaks with them for a little bit and then he goes away. Then a convoy comes by, and next thing you know, I hear a shot, and the driver down below tells me, hey, he's by this wood pile. And I get on my gun, I glass the wood pile, and I'm not seeing anything. So I just keep my gun on the wood pile, and nothing's happening. The two guys that he had spoken with earlier come up to the wood pile, and they kind of come together. And then I see his head pop up, and they kind of human shield him out of there. And I was like, I don't know if I want to take this shot. You know, if I miss and I hit one of these guys, then I'm going to go to jail for it.
Right.
So I let him walk. I'm like, well, I know where he's shooting from now. And then the next day,
I thought you were going to say they brought him a sandwich and a bottle of water or something.
No, he probably did. Probably did some weird shit. The following day, did the same thing, grabbed all my stuff, head out there before it's light, set up my gun, and, I remember one of the cat guys, Corey, him and I were having a conversation because he came out to the patrol base and he's like, "Hey, Patty, you got to come back. The six wants you." I'm like, "What does he need?" And he's like, "I don't know. He says you need to come back with us." And I'm telling him, "I'm kind of busy right now, dude." I'm talking to him like through the top of this turret. And he's like, "I know, man, but he wants you back." And I'm like, "Well, can you get him on the radio and tell him that I'm kind of in the middle of something?" And he's like, "I don't know." And then crack, a tree branch snaps over his head and he gets hit with the splinters of it. And he's like, "All right, I'll get a hold of him."
Yes, I can see you're busy.
Yeah. So, I want to say it was later that same day or the following day, same deal. Jeff hops out of his lead truck and he's got the cigar in his mouth and he's basically flipping the dude off as he's walking across the bridge, leading his truck over it. And so I get on my gun because I've got a convoy coming across it and I know he's probably going to be taking a shot at this point in time. And I'm looking and sure enough, there's a shot that goes off, but it's not from the wood pile. And I look around and there's a squatting figure over underneath one of the trees in the shadows. And I can make out the shape of a rifle. And I've also got 7 tons crossing in front of my field of fire. And I'm right. All right, I'm going to have to time it. And so in between like a 7-ton and a Mat-V that are crossing the bridge, I timed my shot and engaged him. And that guy actually, he got up briefly. He took a second round, and then another gentleman came to pick up his rifle for him, and he scurried off into a cornfield. And so I was tracking on him. I took a shot at him just as he was jumping into the cornfield. I was like, I don't know if that last shot, you know, had a good effect. Luckily we had Mickey, our other air officer, was monitoring the radio, after I called it in, and he had a drone out and was able to confirm that, they were hauling a couple people off. They were hauling off two bodies, after that engagement. So it was good, but I still remember, Jeff walking across the bridge there with a cigar in his mouth and, nice little fuck you to his friends.
A little swagger.
Yeah, but that was the attitude that he had. I mean, he was an excellent leader. I actually, before I came to the sniper platoon, I worked under him while I was in India Company, and he's a real good dude to work for. Real good guy to have on your side.
That's the real same solid dude that got during Musicalo. They got shot in the back in his sappy plate, and yep, was like, "Oh, did I get shot? Well, you have a hole."
Right. A little funny side note about Jeff, as my vehicle commander. Every time we would take contact or someone would take contact, and before we would take off in the truck, our SOP, a little internal SOP within the truck, was he would pull out his Bluetooth speaker and put on "Bad Boys, Bad Boys, What You Gonna Do?" the freaking song. And then he'd be like, "Wait for it. Okay, let's go." And then we'd go.
Yeah, you got to have theme music, dude. Rule number one, so always be cool.
Yeah. We wouldn't do anything unless that song was rolling. And then he would bring out his giant box of cigars and give everybody a cigar, and then we'd take off. Be like, "Let's do this." So much fun.
That's amazing.
It was just so funny because we got so used to, I don't know, taking contact, getting shot at, and everything else, to the point where, like, at that, when we were at PB Bulldog, we'd be inside playing intense games of Rummy. And yes, as soon as
I'm sorry, is there such a thing as an intense game of
Rummy? Yeah, yes, but, yes,
there is.
Oh, yes, there is.
Is there not?
And there I just remember, like,
you guys are like, "Is there, like, any other kind?"
we get upset because they'd start shooting the son of a, and like cards would get thrown around, and freaking, like, guy that was losing would try to wipe everybody's fucking runs and everything, and then, like, we just all throw on gear and just go out and just be like, "All right, here we go again." And it just, we were, like, it got, yeah.
You know, I'm going to get a bunch of fucking emails from people that are like, dude, rummy's the shit. And we get violent with it. And I'm just like, okay. All right. Okay.
Of half naked rummy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, we're in the middle of one game when Leek and Blakey were outside talking in trucks. And that's when they got, I guess you'd call it, hit with an RPG. The RPG finally had hit the outside wall of Bulldog, and they got shrapnel, and they came in like stripped, like off of a movie. You know, it was like slow-mo. They're walking in the front of, right in the entrance of Bulldog, just stripping off their gear, and there's blood dripping down from their sides, and they're like, motherfuckers, you know, these big machine gunners. it was pretty funny. Not funny that they got it.
But their reaction to it and everything.
Yeah, the reaction to it wasn't like, God damn, that hurt. It was motherfuckers, right. You know, and they had fucking holes in their, you know, ribs and shit.
I just don't remember, was that Leak? No, we're finishing this game. I don't give a fuck. No, they're like, dude, no, we need to take care of you, bro. And we got to, I still remember that when we, what was it? We were playing Rummy that one day, and it was Cat White. We were trying to set up that tournament where it was like Cat White versus Kilo 3 guys, where like is like total score matters. And yeah,
we didn't have a shot. You guys were pretty good.
I just don't remember. Oh god, no, we tournament. Got. Oh yeah, no, we were just trying to have fun with it, and then like it was just like instant. And then my favorite part about like it was kind of like R&R for us when we do the rotation to go up to PB Hellman, because since you're a single squad, you don't have to respond to push out the wire to gunshots. You just have to go up to the window and start shooting. So it's like literally you're sitting there as a squad, just like having grappling matches, you know, boxing, fighting each other, playing rummy, you know, making better mousetraps. And then you take contact, and all you do is have to throw on your plate carrier. You can have your silkies on or all the Brit shorts we stole from the Brits / traded them for.
You can have your silkies on. That was the permanent uniform for the snipers and PB Hellman. It was just silkies and 50 cal. That's the only thing that was required.
But you gotta roll them up.
There's nothing sexier than a Marine in silkies carrying a 50 cal. I mean,
it was like that had to have been the SOP out there. You weren't allowed to shoot the 50 unless you were half naked wearing your silkies.
Well, anybody who's been listening to this podcast a while knows that one of John's favorite firefight stories, he was in his helmet, boots, plate carrier, and a silky firing. Yeah. Like, yeah, it was great.
I also recall that there was a sense of pride in anybody that's able to maintain positive control of their cigarette throughout the firefight.
Is that like when you don't spill your beer?
Out, you're a fucking loser.
I'm pretty sure I still, although, you know, there was a couple that competed with me, but I'm pretty sure I won that because I was able to reload 3 times while smoking the same cigarette. So
yeah,
that should tell you how much ammo you were going through, because the cigarette's only of about 3.5 to 6 minutes, depending on how
and
you smoke.
I was just keeping the side of my mouth, and I was going out of PB Hellman, and I was literally plate carrier and silkies and just shooting out the one window. And that's actually when we found the first 55-gallon drum in Hellman. We had been there for about 2 months at this point, and the one post where we were all digging our feet into, all of a sudden there's a blue drum below us. And so we ended up having to dig it up, and it was one of their hiding points that there was nothing in it, but we had been standing on it for about 2 months at that point.
You know, it's always nice to find you've been standing on something for 2 months that could have killed you.
Minor details. Yeah. At that point, it was just like, how do you put that? Hey, I saw this in a movie once.
Right. Well, we're running out of time for today, but I appreciate you guys being here. Did you guys, at this point, you guys have pushed across the Mississippi and you're branching out into the area beyond it. And next week, I think we have about 2 episodes left as we get into this. Jacob, why don't you tell us what we're going to go through in the next 2 episodes as we finish out the series?
Basically, this wraps up the Kilo expedition. I mean, obviously, we started pushing further up towards Kajaki. just seeing how bad it was going to be and everything. We were kind of the guinea pigs for that. But honestly, at this point, I think for this next episode, we're going to be focusing on what's the actual city center, which is like the fishbowl area and everything else, which like over there in Sangam, we had what's called the horseshoe, where it was basically a pre-designated area with walls and compounds that basically, if you pushed into that area, they would hit you everywhere and you couldn't get out of it. Like no matter which way, left, right, even with wall jumpers, they actually put glass across the top of the mud walls. So if you try to climb up on top of the walls, you had someone throw you up, you'd immediately cut yourself on the glass.
So, poor man's barbed wire.
Yep, basically. So we're going to be going into that whole deal of India Company and Lima Company's push over the next 2 weeks, because obviously then Cat White got pulled out away from us, except for a handful. Shadow got pulled out, except for the two guys and what they were doing with their pushes.
Sounds good. Lorenzo, I'm going to ask you straight up to come back again to tell us some fireman stories from the Pacific Northwest, because you've obviously got two sets of stories. You've got your Marine sniper stories, and then you've got stories from being a firefighter up at the Pacific Northwest, if you're game.
Yeah, I mean, I get around, so.
Ooh, I'm excited to hear it. Yeah. Carrie, again, thanks for joining us. I appreciate you as always. And we always like having you on, especially because you're kind of like Jacob's color commentator. You provide, hey, that's a, let me back up, because there's a great story you fucking missed.
Yeah, seriously. Yeah. We were kind of like the ragged dog that kind of drug around with them, you know, and then provided support if they needed us. But
right.
We were there pretty much watching everything go down the whole time.
And so I thank you guys for being here. And this is our first episode of 2021. So like we said in our year in review, let's hope this year doesn't turn out to be as shitty. But somehow, as John and I said, I have a feeling this year we're going to need to buckle up for some other shit. But we'll see what happens. And you guys, I appreciate you coming on. Until our next episode, come home with your shield or own it.